a discussion on what a Me Too film is. Shitty jobs are just not as attractive as a sexy, hot Bruce Willis criminal who drinks cappuccino. And a busted microphone with some explosive diarrhea just shows Walter can't be professional no matter how hard he tries. Welcome to Fake Film Fans.
Welcome to Fake Film Fans. I'm Suede Best, your Bruce Willis fanboy.
Hey, I'm Walter, and I'm Alice.
And I'm Catherine, and I'm a wild donkey chewing grass in your backyard. Also, I want everyone to know that Walter is under a blanket right now, and it's hilarious.
It's true. We're having audio trouble, and to deal with the round sort of like echoing Walter's audio, I instructed him to put a blanket over himself. He thinks it's going to help the audio. It's actually not. I'm just fucking with him. It's very funny.
Wait, should I take off the blanket?
No, I was kidding, Walt. The blanket is good for the audio. It dampens the sound.
Oh, okay.
I'm glad no one actually, not a whole lot of people listen to this, because otherwise they'd lambast me for my lack of audio knowledge. I think that's supposed to help, though. So, I know normally we start off by sort of talking about what's going on in our zones. I had this idea I kind of wanted to try, and I was wondering if you guys were, or maybe, are you guys a little hungry?
I'm starving.
You're starving? What about you, Walt? Are you hungry?
I can be hungry. Hunger is kind of a mindset thing, right?
Okay, not true. That's patently false, but okay.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure. Why? How is hunger a mindset?
Because your stomach hurt doesn't mean your brain has to relate it to hunger.
I see, sort of like a warrior's mentality, like kind of like an intense like body power.
Exactly. And some people who are masochists might like the feeling of pain in their stomach. Would that be called hunger, or would that be called sexy time?
That is a good question. How about this? You don't get to eat for the rest of the month and tell me how sexy you feel at the end of it. Can you do that for me?
Well, I'm not a masochist, so that just wouldn't work.
No more eating. Catherine, can you corroborate? All in favor of Walter not eating food for the next month, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All against?
Aye.
You've been outvoted again, Walt. Sorry. Well, I'm hoping you're hungry for this next little segment I like to call the Buffett Buffet.
Oh, no!
Yes, that's right. I'm quizzing you all on some quality Jimmy Buffett lyrics.
Oh, God.
Anyone's unsure of Jimmy Buffett, he's the party beach boy, rockin' pirate, beach musician, leader of the Parrot Heads, and just all around good beachy guy. It's been very cold and wet and sad in Roanoke, so I've been blasting Jimmy Buffett in the bookstore, and I thought of a few questions. So I think I want to start with this one right here. In Jimmy Buffett's hit song, Cheeseburger in Paradise, does he like his burgers medium rare with A, ketchup, B, mayo, or C, mustard?
I'm gonna say ketchup.
You've locked in your answer at A, ketchup.
I fundamentally disagree that this is a multiple choice question. Can it be open-ended?
So this is referencing the source text. If you want, I can tell you the source text.
Okay, so I have the multiple choice pen. B.
Can you explain to us what the multiple choice pen is really quick?
The multiple choice pen is what you guys see in all the television shows. There's an A on one side, a B on one side, and a C on one side, and you roll the pencil for the answer.
Okay, so you're just guessing.
Basically, 90% correct.
Okay, so you think it's B?
Yes.
All right, so according to the lyrics, cheeseburger in paradise, medium rare with mustard be nice, heaven on earth with an onion slice. I'm cheeseburger in paradise. So the answer was, in fact, mustard. You were both incorrect. I'm sorry.
So this is still a vegan hamburger.
So I actually looked at the text. He does talk about the hamburger being meat on a bun. So it is not for vegans. And I am sorry for that. I'm going to keep score, by the way, every time we do this bit. I don't think we're going to do this bit every episode, but I plan on doing it every once in a while. And we're going to have a tallying score. And when this podcast is like finally over because Walter's died of alcohol abuse or I've died from sort of a various level of illnesses. I know, Catherine, you're going to be the one to survive. You're clearly the healthiest out of all of us. At the end of the podcast, whoever's gotten the most right will be championed, the Buffett Lord.
Won't I win if I outlive you guys?
Well, no, because at that point, it's all about the points. I mean, win in life, yes, but not in the Buffett contest.
Okay, I'll take it.
And I get it. You're trying to do this so that we start listening to more Jimmy Buffett songs so that we can try to win.
Yeah, exactly. And the questions are going to get harder. So this is question two. This is a three-question
book. Wait, whoa. I did not know there were multiple Jimmy Buffett questions.
They're just three. Just bear with me. I'm sorry. Everyone who's listening to this episode, if you hate this bit, tweet at fake film fans and tell us how bad the bit is. And I'll keep doing it and it's fine. But I want tell me if it's bad. And I'll still keep doing it because I'm an asshole like that. Question two. Jimmy describes one food by saying, a piece of French bread to wipe my bowl. Good for the body, good for the soul. It's a little like religion and a lot like sex. You should never know when you're going to get it next. Is Jimmy Buffett talking about A, menudo, B, lobster bisque, or C, gumbo?
What's menudo?
Menudo is, oh man. So it's a spicy soup from Latin America. I think its genesis is Mexico, but I'm probably 100% completely wrong. And I'm terrible if someone wants to fact check me.
I feel like that's the one that uses intestines.
Menudo does use intestines.
What's the second option?
Lobster bisque.
And the third was gumbo. I'm going to go with lobster bisque.
Okay.
I'm going to go with gumbo.
Well, despite having no knowledge of Jimmy Buffett, Walter, you are correct. That is from the hit song,
Yay!
I Will Play for Gumbo, in which Jimmy Buffett says that he has no vices other than the fact that he loves gumbo. And for the last question, we're going to go with a Jimmy Buffett classic. In his hit song, Wasting Away Again in Margaritaville, is he nibbling on sponge cake, living on crab cakes, or nursing a headache?
Living on crab cakes.
That's your answer, Cavern? All right. C, nursing a headache.
I'm sorry, it's wrong. While Jimmy Buffett is watching the sun bake and seeing all the tourists covered in oil, he is in fact nibbling on sponge cake.
Oh my god. I failed.
Walter, you're ahead by one, so just everyone in the Wikipedia record Walter has one Jimmy Buffett point.
Wait, Catherine said nibbling on sponge cake.
No, she said living on crab cakes, which is incorrect. But I see why Catherine did it, because Jimmy Buffett is a beachy boy.
Yeah, I wanted to choose the nautical theme.
And you know, I like that chutzpah. I like that energy. I think you're I think you're in the right zone. I think you gotta study up a little bit. I know you're in graduate school. Is there maybe a major you could switch to, a Jimmy Buffett-style major of some kind?
Jimmy Buffett studies.
Yes, yes.
I'll look into it. I'll have to ask the registrar.
I could teach a class if you're interested.
Speaking of this, I recently heard that in Japan, they have classes that teach you how to be a professional JoJo poser.
Is that true?
Ooh.
Yeah, a JoJo Bizarre Adventurer pose, and you can learn lessons to how to do it professionally.
That's pretty hype. Have you absorbed much JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Catherine?
A little bit. One of my exes really liked it, so I've absorbed some of it.
You endured some of it. That's a good...
I absorbed, but also endured.
Was this ex, did he have a fedora?
No.
He didn't have a katana either?
No.
It is pretty crazy how different the audience of JJBA has changed from, like, the original manga when the anime hasn't come out, where it was, like, considered the ultimate cult seinen fiction.
Yeah.
And then now it's, like, it's almost as mainstream as, like, Naruto.
It's pretty mainstream, yeah. I know, like, I was substitute teaching, like, middle school and high school, and, like, they all were, like, obsessed with JoJo. Not that, like, that means it's mainstream, but I kind of feel like it is. I don't know.
No, I agree. I think if a middle schooler likes it, it's either, like, the most weird, bizarre shit you can think of, or it is the most mainstream.
Or it's a goat, like Dino Trucks.
Oh, like Dino Trucks.
I just want to finish this point. All I meant by this, Suede, is that initially, the discourse around JJBA was that it was too weird, and that's why it was cult. And the loyal fan base loved the weird shit, and that's why it could have such a long series running despite it not being the most popular action manga of all time. So to see all that weird shit that people thought was too weird for mainstream become mainstream just because it's marketed well on Netflix, it just shows that mainstream's, it's the difference between art house and mainstream literally means nothing.
It's about what's marketable. I mean, you're right. It's about what you can shove down people's gullets.
Hospital recovering from getting all the bubble gum scraped out of my intestine. I watched this really interesting film. I think it came out in 2019, so it's pretty new. I've been wanting to watch it for a while. by a Canadian director called Kitty Green. It's called The Assistant. But some people call it like a Me Too movie. I'm not sure if I like really would agree with that. But it's almost like a thriller, like an office thriller. So it's like this girl has this really shitty job in some production company in New York, and her boss is an asshole, but you never see him. So you just kind of see how everyone reacts to his presence in the office, and it kind of creates this like weird tension and mystery that's kind of cool. And the movie is so good at just giving the vibe of how it feels to work in a really depressing office, from like the really sad microwave meals to like the fact that making a small mistake on like an email or schedule is like a really big deal. I wanted to ask you guys what the worst job you've ever had was, and see if it was related to the experience of watching this movie in any way.
So I worked for a pizza place that's now defunct. And I'm not going to say the name of it because I think... No, so the pizza place that I worked at is no longer there, but I think the franchise still exists. So I'm not gonna put them on blast. But you could effectively call it Meth Mouth Pizza is a pretty accurate descriptor. Not the owner, but the working manager got paid under the table. So the rest of us got paid under the table. And I once asked him why we were getting paid under the table. And he said that he had warrants out for his arrest in South Carolina.
Oh my God.
He said they were for spousal abuse and sort of having a drug den, like owning a drug den. And I said, that sounds pretty bad, man. And he said, well, it's not really how it went. You know, me and my old lady got in a fist fight, but it was fair. Which is like a crazy thing to say. And then he said, and it wasn't a drug den. There was just a lot of meth in the house.
Nice.
So that kind of sets up the tenor. It was just like me and a bunch of like old bigoted rednecks. And then this one dude who was from Iran, I think, who was like had a bunch of computer license skills in Iran, but couldn't get them to transfer over to the U.S. So he was working on getting these degrees back. And in the meantime, he was just like this like overqualified person working at this like shitty pizza place. He was like very clearly the smartest and most educated out of everyone there. And it was just like it was terrible. Just I mean, they were just like terrible people. I worked there until I told them I was going back to college and that I gave my 2 weeks. I was like, I'm going back to college. You know, maybe when I'm done with college, I'll come work here again. And they said, nah, you're good. And just fired me there on the spot. Oh, the boss also. The reason why it's no longer in place is because the boss had a coke habit.
The boss in this movie may be pretty different from your drug-addled boss, but we still know that he sucks because the first thing that happens in this movie is she has to clean cum off of a couch.
Jesus.
But again, you never see him. So it's always just her like putting stuff in his office or like answering phone calls from him. And it's like, he's obviously like exploiting girls in the industry and like sleeping with them. She has to like field phone calls from his wife and stuff.
So he's like a Harvey Weinstein?
Yeah, exactly. And everyone throughout the movie is like, you'll be fine. Like, you're not his type. Like, you'll be fine because he's not like fucking you. And it's like, that's not the point, everyone. That's why it's kind of interesting, because like the main character is just like witness to everything that's going on. So it was cool in that way. Yeah, it definitely reminded me of some shitty jobs I've had. She has like terrible conversation with HR, who just like tells her that he's not going to report it. So it was kind of a creepy movie about the patriarchy. But Walter, I didn't ask you what's the worst job that you've ever had.
Well, I'm incredibly privileged, so I don't think I've really had a job that's bad. I've enjoyed most of my work.
Walter likes his jobs because he gets to try on poverty for a little bit. He's like, ooh, I'm gonna have a job. I'm gonna work 9 to 5. And when I'm done, my mommy and daddy will give me $8,000. Ooh.
That's kind of how it works, yeah.
I know, I lived with you.
Yeah. I have bad days at work, and there was one time I got fired in 2 days and I cried, but I think I already mentioned that in the podcast.
You did,
the dumplings.
Aww.
Can I say something, though, on another try-on poverty thing? At one of the places I used to work at, my boss used to give me microwave meals, and I loved them.
Oh my god. There's just something about, it's like so bland, the colors, and she's just in this dark office by herself, like, punching the plastic of the thing, and it's like, it was like visceral to me. I was like, oh, like
it's funny though, because like microwave meals, they're like microwave meals, and then there's like microwave meals. So there's like these $7 microwave meals, and then there's like these $2 microwave meals, where like no matter how much you microwave them, the pasta will still remain hard. And that's what my boss was giving me. And like Tori didn't want to eat it after he tried one of them. Sway didn't even bother. Sway doesn't even touch like normal microwave meals most of the time, but Tori really likes microwave meals, but he fucking could not stand the $2 ones. So I had to finish them. They were fun.
I will always just eat an egg over, like, I would rather live off hard-boiled eggs than eat a microwave food. The closest I come to that is I do consume toaster oven waffles pretty regularly. But, so Catherine, you unlike Walter, you don't live in some sort of gilded palace. What's the worst job you've ever had?
I was thinking about that. So this movie specifically was reminding me of, like, office jobs I've had. Possibly the worst job I've ever had, though, was also at a pizza place, was like a register girl, and the cooks were behind me and they would always make comments about my ass.
Oh god, how old were you?
I was probably like 17.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But the worst job that I had that was like psychologically just like punishing in the way that I think like office work can be was like after I graduated from Goucher, I got this job at this really terrible company in Baltimore. And I was like just working downtown in this like little building with a bunch of people like in their 40s. And like I would just go and sit at my desk and like do shit on my computer that was really menial tasks. Like I was helping them code email newsletters to send out to people. And so I would just sit on my desk and code in HTML all day. Then I would make small talk with people at lunch, and then I would go home. And I like would be surrounded by people, but wouldn't talk to anyone really. And it was just like somehow that atmosphere is just so stuffy. I was extremely unhappy, even though like I was making like the most money I'd ever made because it was like a real job, you know, real full-time job. But it was horrible. Like
I get that. I think there's something particularly horrible about these jobs where you're not actually doing anything. I mean, that's like some like Marxist nonsense, which is not to say there's anything wrong with Marxism, but just like whatever. I'm not gonna die on this hill. But like this idea that you get, what is it? You get alienated from your work.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's nightmarish, and when I worked at the theater, I felt that way quite a bit. And if it wasn't for the fact that like I had some homies there who were like my own age, and the job was so easy, I could do whatever the fuck I wanted, and like all the managers were so ineffectual and weak, I could kind of do whatever the fuck I wanted. If they'd wanted me to take it seriously, I would not have lasted, just because of how being a middleman is like soul crushing.
Yeah. The thing about this job was it was so easy, but I was surrounded by people in this open office plan. I had to pretend like I was working on this shit all day that would take me like 2 hours to finish. So anyways, if you've ever had a terrible office job, maybe don't watch this movie because it might trigger you. But it was really good. It's a good movie about like how the patriarchy is super pervasive and can infect every part of an organization.
Here's a question that I have. First of all, you said you don't really consider this a Me Too movement film. So I'm kind of curious, maybe try to define what that means. Like, what is a Me Too film? And then secondly, I'm curious because this girl, the main character, is kind of a bystander of her boss's sexual exploits, right? The thing is, in today's society, or at least when we were in Goucher, bystanders were usually just considered perpetuators, not as much as the actual assaulter or anything like that. But if you were a bystander, that was never a good thing. So does this movie blame her? I mean, what is it trying to say?
No,
about
yeah, I hear what you're saying. That's a really good point. And I could have explained the plot better, too.
I think you did a fantastic job, Catherine. I just want to
thank you, sweet.
You shouldn't let Walter bully you at all.
Everyone in the whole like company, which is like this big production company in New York, like knows that the boss is like this. So in a way, every single person is a bystander. Except for this one girl who's an assistant to him and is totally powerless, just started. She does actually go to HR and she's like, listen, like, here's the things that I've seen happening. Like, what can I do? And the guy looks at her and he goes, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to write this report? And then it ruins your whole career of you wanting to become a producer. He's like, I can write this report for you, but do you really want me to do that? And she's basically like bullied out of like doing anything by the HR person. And like when she's leaving, the HR person is like the one who's like, don't worry, like you're not his type. So like everyone knows what's going on. And that's like kind of what is the most creepy about this film is like, as more stuff happens, people start like making little comments and acknowledgements where you realize that like literally everyone knows this happening and does nothing. I guess it kind of is a Me Too movie. I guess I meant like, it's not in the sense where it's like, she is not the one experiencing the harassment, except for like, he does like verbally harass her on the phone. You see her like picking up the phone and he's like yelling shit at her sometimes. But yeah, I guess I was imagining like a Me Too movie being like where the main character is like the one experiencing like the harassment and like fighting against it. But I guess that doesn't mean that this isn't one, because it's very much about like abuse of power and how it goes unchecked.
There was that big Me Too movie that came out where it was about, I can't remember the title, but with the female news anchors. I remember it had three different actresses, including the lady who plays, what is her name? Who plays Harley Quinn.
Oh, how do you not know her name? You're like obsessed with her. Margot Robbie.
Bombshell. Bombshell is the film I'm talking about.
Wait, I didn't know you were obsessed with Margot Robbie.
Well, he's obsessed with Harley Quinn.
I am, but I'm specifically obsessed with, just to be fair, the Batman, the animated series Harley Quinn.
2D okay. Better than 3D.
Rule number one, you're not allowed to be lewd to your co-host. We established that last episode. And there was a second rule.
It's no bad movies.
No bad movies. Oh, yeah, we're not allowed to say there's such thing as bad movies. That's number two. Number three, always 2D girls and boys, but let's be honest, girls are better than 3D ones.
I don't ratify this third rule.
The third rule is going to need some debate.
We could vote on it, but I know what's going to happen. But I want to use voting only to bully Walter, so I don't think it's fair.
This is what I was actually trying to ask, though. I meant, like, do you think labeling a film as a Me Too film is helpful? Like, Me Too films are so diverse, right? But then to call them Me Too films kind of seems to strip them of that type of diversity. And I don't mean that sexual assault should be diverse and that's a good thing. But there are many different types of abuse that can be sexual violence and through power relationships. Everyone has such a visceral understanding of what hashtag Me Too is.
Yeah, I think definitely like me hearing that it was like a Me Too movie, as much as that even is a real genre, which I don't think it is, but I definitely heard that and like thought like, oh, it's about like someone fighting against, I don't know, like had a specific idea of like what it would be about. And that's maybe why I said it didn't seem like a hashtag Me Too movie. But I think that's like my own like stereotypes I have with like what it would mean to call something a Me Too movie. And that you're right, it's like it's totally diverse. Like the movies that deal with sexual assault and abuse of power, are any of those called a Me Too movie? I guess, I don't know. Like, then we get into like the weird like genre label shit.
I don't know if we want to go down this rabbit hole, but like, is Kill Bill a Me Too movie, or I Spit on Your Grave, or what is it, Lady Snowblood? Is that the martial arts series? Lady Scorpion, Lady Snowblood?
Yeah, Lady Snowblood.
You're basically asking if rape and revenge movies, are they Me Too films?
No, I think this one really should be, because, well, what the fuck do I know? But I think Me Too is specifically about, like, abusive power in the workplace. And so I think that, and specifically, didn't it start with, like, Harvey Weinstein and shit in film? Or am I wrong?
Yeah, if it didn't start with Harvey Weinstein, it started with someone just like him, I think.
Yeah, so I feel like this movie, if anything, like, would be that. But I think genre labels are kind of silly. And I guess you could say that, like, rape revenge is connected to it. But I think of Me Too as, like, workplace harassment. Okay. I don't know, so...
Well, I think that's an interesting bubble to create. I've only ever watched Batman cartoons, so I don't have a whole lot of ways to weigh in on this.
Isn't the whole city Batman's workplace, though?
That's true, but Batman...
And he's just the abuser.
No, Batman is not an... Okay, I'm not... We're not... The only people that Batman abuses are bad guys, Walt, so... And I guess... don't know, he's pretty mean to Robin sometimes, but I don't think that's abuse. I think that's just like bad father energy.
And Alfredo.
His name's not Alfredo, Walt. His name is Alfred, and he's very nice to Alfred.
It would be a lot cooler if his name was Alfredo, so whenever he served Batman as a butler for food, he would just cut off a bit of his skin and be like, "Hello, Alfredo sauce."
Batman doesn't get hungry. Hunger is just a state of mind. Well, Batman doesn't get hungry.
Oh, I apologize. You're right.
That's right.
He's a warrior. It's a warrior mindset. I think we should sort of tonally jackknife from Catherine's sort of like very, very serious film to Hudson Hawk, which I watched, the 1991 Bruce Willis classic, directed by the same author who directed The Heathers, a movie I have not seen, and probably won't, even though I know it's Walter's favorite film. Actually, wait, before we start, I have a question for Catherine. Has Walter ever told you that you're not allowed to watch some of his favorite pieces of media because if you don't like them, he's going to be really upset?
No. I think Walter doesn't tell me about movies he knows I won't like.
Okay, see, Walter, and we don't have this with movies much, but, like, Walter for a long time said I couldn't read Aria, this slice of life sci-fi manga, because if I didn't like it, we were going to stop being friends. And I did actually really enjoy it. Aria, he likes other manga that's really bad, like, 21st Century Boys. Yeah, he really didn't want me to read Aria, and I feel like if I watched Heathers and didn't like it, it would, like, kind of put a pretty severe rift in our friendship.
Heathers not so much, honestly.
Yeah.
Aria very specifically, because you know why it is? It's because someone can get caught up in Aria's like cutesy girls and like think I like it for like different reasons than why I recommend.
This is a 100% recommend. If you read manga at all and you like slice of life stuff, or you're interested in sort of like the idea of melancholy in fiction, read Aria. It's fantastic. Hudson Hawk, on the other hand, is fucking wild. So the premise is that Bruce Willis is a genius-ass cat thief. He's, like, really good at it. And his name is Eddie, but he goes by Hudson Hawk because he's from Hudson in New York. And he's just, like, very good at being a thief, right? As it turns out, his quirks about theft is that he and his partner, Tommy, his, like, partner in crime, they don't synchronize their watches when they do crime. Instead, they both sing the same song and that they've memorized. So for the first theft, Bruce Willis and, oh, what is it, Danny Aiello sing, oh, what is it? It's the classic, do you want to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar. I think it was
Dynatrix's theme song.
Oh my God, I'm gonna fucking move all the way to Hong Kong.
Wait, that was beautiful.
Thanks. I can carry a tune. I've actually been thinking about starting a punk cover band for Jimmy Buffett songs called Jimmy Fuck It.
You told this story already.
I'm sorry.
You're only allowed to reference Jimmy Buffett like 3 times in the podcast, okay?
Okay. I'm sorry. That's the fifth rule. You're only allowed to reference Jimmy Buffett once, okay?
Only Dino Chucks can be referenced more than once.
Okay. No, but it's so Bruce Willis has a musical career. It's not like super popular, but he does. And so he sings these like old swing songs really fantastically. The plot is pretty crazy. Basically, this evil couple wants to tank the world economy, so they want to steal these like artifacts that will make a machine that Leonardo da Vinci made that will turn lead into gold, and they're going to destroy the world economy. I'm not really actually really interested in talking about the plot.
Wait, why does it say on, when I Google it, it says he's released from prison and all he wants is a nice cappuccino. Is cappuccinos important to the plot?
Yes, it is. He doesn't, you don't ever see him drink booze, but you do see him wanting to drink a cappuccino. And each time he goes to get a drink a cappuccino, he gets interrupted until the end of the film. And the one time you get to see him drink a cappuccino before that, he actually passes out because it's been laced with sleeping, like poison that makes him fall asleep.
Wow.
It's like a really weird movie. I would kind of put it up there with like Monkey Bone, if you've ever seen that, or like The Mask, and like how weird it is. It's like very light on plot, and kind of what made it for me at least was A, how weird it is, and B, how like everyone commits to the bit as actors. Like there's no one in this movie that's not acting their ass off. It panned terribly. Everyone hates it. It got 3 different Razzies, which are like the I Hate Movies awards. I don't get it. This, by the way, is in my top 5. I literally watched it for the first time about 4 hours ago, and it is rocketed up to like number 8 on my top 5 list. Wow. It is so good.
Number 8 on your top 5.
I'm sorry. Numbers are hard.
I understand what you mean, because if you have 8 apples, you can chop them up into 16 apples.
That's true.
And then if you combine the 16 apples in different shapes, you can make 5 circle apples.
Who said that? Was that Jean Locke, Walt?
Yes.
Catherine, I don't know why I don't always just say these words to you, because I know you're like so much more capable of communication than Walter is.
That is only usually true.
So I really like this movie. Watch it. The dialogue is really weird. It's really sharp. It's never a slow moment in this movie. There's all these weird visual gags that happen all over. The action is really zany. It's not like one of these crime action movies where, like, you know, people are like fighting and they're like, it's like really intense and gritty. It's like a total zany movie, but it also makes you want to do crime. It's one of those movies that will make you want to like be a criminal and like steal stuff, kind of like Ocean's 11, but it's so much funnier. The real reason I think I brought this, though, is that we've sort of sometimes joked about how this podcast in a lot of ways is sort of a sexual exploration of sort of my
Have staff. We joked that?
I feel like we've made a couple jokes about that. When I think about men I would like to sleep with, usually it's me having sex with them, in part because of my own fragile toxic masculinity, and also because I just like to be in charge in every aspect of my own existence. I want Bruce Willis to have sex with me so bad.
Wow.
I just like, oh my, entirely through this movie. He's so handsome. He's so cheeky. He's got a beautiful singing voice.
I did notice the little earrings on the poster. Is it the earrings that made it?
I just want him to like sweep me up in a blanket out somewhere in Milan and just be like, oh, Suede, let me tell you about this thing I stole while I sing you Frank Sinatra songs. And I would be putty in his rough hands.
Oh my
his
gosh.
Rough criminal hands.
So you don't care about the bald head at all, huh?
He's not bald in the movie, but I don't mind, you know, bald folks, men or women. I don't mind.
All I'm saying is that usually when I hear people talk about Bruce Willis, they talk about, oh, and I just want my hands on his head and I can touch the slimy, gooey baldness.
Mm-hmm. John Locke said that too, right, Catherine?
Yes, he did.
But because you didn't reference it, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That was all.
No, he's just like, I don't know, he's like so... I sort of feel this way about Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11, actually. Sort of like anyone who's like good at crime, but like not the crime where like you're stabbing a poor mother of 3 in an alleyway. Like, that sucks. That's not sexy crime. Or like ruining a family's financial existence by like Bernie Madoff style, like pranking everyone's money. That's not sexy crime. But like, if someone could like sneak into my house and like take my TV and like leave a rose and a note that says like from Jean Pierre, I would just be like, okay, it's fine. Take my TV. Come back. Take me and take my TV. Criminals, man, they're sexy. Like,
totally. Bad boys.
Like the Unabomber.
Yeah, just like the Unabomber.
I don't know who the Unabomber is.
You should learn about him. He's very cool.
No, he's not.
I've not read his theses, his philosophies. I don't know, actually. He's probably a bad guy. Are we down with domestic terrorism? Is that, like, not something we're about?
It depends on what it's for.
Weather Underground is cool, right? Like, we're pro-Weather Underground.
Yeah.
But we're not pro the Boston Bombers.
No. No, no.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to know where we were with sort of domestic terrorism. The Unabomber was a Luddite. He was anti-technology. He was unstable and thought technology was going to ruin the world.
I mean, you shouldn't do violence for a silly reason.
I don't think the Unabomber thought it was silly, I will say.
I might think it's silly. I actually don't know anything about, like, really why he did it, so...
Did we talk about the Bjorkstalker on the podcast?
Oh my god, no.
Okay, the Bjorkstalker was a silly terrorist. He was being very silly with his terrorism.
Can I ask a question about Bruce Willis, though? You said he's a singer. Maybe because I don't understand what that would look like, I would like to know why you said that when Bruce Willis sings, it sounds really good. Because I just can't imagine it.
It's kind of like husky and like...
You don't think Suede did a great job of sort of doing it for us?
I can like do it from the movie a little bit more. I can do like a more... He's like, and if you want to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better. You know, he's got kind of like throaty, a little bit like
Yeah, I think it's great.
You know, like Amy Winehouse.
I didn't realize Suede was an exact replication of Bruce Willis. So I didn't realize when he did his example, it was literally Bruce Willis singing.
And that's my fault. I'm sorry I didn't let Bruce Willis is actually he's my brother. It's bad that I want to have sex with him because we're related through time. Yeah, watch the movie. Fucking fantastic. Anyone who doesn't like it has no taste. Rule of the six to the podcast. Hudson Hawk is a good movie.
I want to watch it.
I mean, I think it's the kind of movie you could watch with pretty much everyone. It's also surprisingly not got all that many, like, spicy jokes. Like, I was a little worried because it's from 1991. It kind of passed my smell test. Outside of there's one joke where he says something about the handicaps.
Oh.
He says the handicaps. That's, like, maybe not a great turn of phrase. So his parole officer wants him to do crime now that he's out of jail because he's a bad parole officer. And I can't remember. Bruce Willis says something like, right, next thing you're going to say, you want me to teach tap dancing lessons to handicaps or something. Something along those lines. It's just like a one-off line. It's like, you know, that's not a very nice thing to say about people in general. And there are probably plenty of people who are differently bodied who can do tap dancing.
The first thing I want to ask is, Wade asked Catherine about some of the pretentious things I've said. So I'm curious if you guys ever heard me make this claim. Did you guys ever hear me say something like, Iran and Brazil are the two most underrated filmmaking countries in the world?
Yeah, I've heard you say that, and that you also like the movie Brazil a whole lot.
Interesting.
I don't hate Brazil. I just don't care for it like some other people do. That is all.
I don't think I've heard you say this. Brazil and what was the other country?
Iran.
Oh, well, you've definitely said it about Iran. That sounds like something you said.
Okay.
See, and I remember you talking more about Brazil.
Oh, so it must have been like a movement where I used to love Iran and then move into Brazil, which I actually believe. I think that actually happened in my life. Yeah, the reason why I brought that up, though, is because both of these places, I don't call them underrated just because I think they have a lot of good movies that get overlooked. I think they have a very diverse filmmaking curriculum.
You mean like as in like a school of an art? Like, an
like they have... lots of different kinds of film coming out of there.
Yes, exactly. And both of them have a pretty big history, too. The film I brought, though, is by Eduardo Contino. He's a good example of diversity because he's a documentary filmmaker and he makes really, really interesting and, like, experimental documentaries. He's really famous for a film called 20 Years Later. He basically tries to do a documentary in 1967, but then fails to complete it. And, like, a lot of his crew gets shut down by censorship and all this stuff. Then 20 years later, he goes back to that place he wanted to make a documentary about and sort of tries to finish it but realizes he can't. So he just films, like, 20 years later of this place. And the reason why it was shut down was because it was kind of a, I don't know the right term, but Brazil had movements of peasant rebellions. He played with this time thing in his documentary, so I thought that was really cool. The movie I'm bringing, though, is Playing, Jogo de Cena, and that's one of his newer films, made in 2007. And it's basically a bunch of women getting interviewed to audition to tell their life stories. And then in the middle of the film, actresses sort of repeat their stories and, like, they reenact the interview. So at first, it's pretty obvious which ones are actresses, but then, like, the order starts becoming messier. And then you start getting surprised which ones are actresses and which ones are not. In fact, it's never really stated completely. So I guess maybe some of the interviews I think are the real ones might not even be. So who the fuck knows? Why I have a lot of love for this film is because in the same way in the last podcast I talked about Perfumed Nightmare, I just really like these type of meta films. So Perfumed Nightmare is sort of a fictional work that integrates documentary work, while this one integrates acting, filmmaking, and like storytelling into documentary work. Yeah, so it's like kind of plays around with that, and not like the only thing that matters in this film because it's mostly just talking, and not every single interview is the most interesting interview of all time, but it's still like fun to enjoy these type of meta films.
You know, it's interesting. I was actually just reading. It's very similar, but it's a sort of hybrid collection of poetry, memoir, and also a novel. Really, really nice little paperback called Split Tooth, written by I can't remember what sort of group she's from, but she's a First Nations woman from Canada, and it's very similar. Like, it's a lot of true stuff about what's happened to her and some of her poems, but it's also got a like fictionalized narrative, and it was really there are a lot of novels that are like this that are really engaging, and I don't know why my attention isn't grabbed when it comes to movies like that. I guess because I
wanted to ask Walter, like, why he thinks he likes these movies so much, because a lot of your favorite movies, like Mirror, talking about Iranian movies, have this like element of like, it's very meta. Oh, we're doing filmmaking, but are we? That's really making it sound a lot less cool than it is. But like, what do you think, like, the appeal of that is for you?
Because I like it when a medium is specifically only able to be done in that specific medium. Some of these questions about, can this be filmmaking? Can this not be filmmaking? Yeah, you could write it and adapt it into a book. I mean, it might work into, like, you can still question, like, what is filmmaking, but it doesn't feel as layered. Because the movie itself is one layer. And if you adapt that into a book, you miss out on that layer. And because of that, it really drills out those nuances. A lot of people like to think of all these storytelling mediums as just different mediums. But they're not. There's something more specific about every single one of them. To go on what you were talking about, Suede, about books, one of the things I think why these meta books are different from meta films is because every single word on the page is a direction to what your reader has to be paying attention to. On the other hand, a meta film, it's kind of up to the watcher. Like, the director can direct your brain into focusing on what. But like, if I'm watching this movie where it's only just interviews, I'm going to blank out on some of the stuff they say, because everyone blanks out when they talk to conversations. They might have accidentally started focusing on their hand movements and forgotten to listen to the words. You might be completely paying attention to the red chairs in the back, and the director might not have even thought about those red chairs have any meaning.
Are you talking about the viewers, Walt, or are you talking about the actors?
The viewers. I'm talking about as a viewer. But for books, as a reader, you're always paying attention to the words. So you're always following what the author is directing you to do. I'm not saying you can't blank out when you read.
So this is on Walter's YouTube channel. But he has this video about Naked Killers, which is a movie we both watched. And I helped write the script a little bit, because I'm just good at basically everything. But one of the things that you really liked about the movie was the colors, right? And I remember watching the movie with you and mostly thinking about the action and, like, the ladies, like, with her, like, giant sword hat. And you were like, look at the chairs, look at the colors. And I was like, you're right, it's like a totally different
viewership. Yeah, we're watching the same movie. Yeah. We're literally two different types of viewings, and it's still very fun, and you can still talk about the same movie. But yeah,
I think you can do that with words, though. I will say, I think you can do that with words. It's just a little more complicated.
I agree, Suede. I was thinking about that. Like, it's not, I think, Walter, you're right, what you're saying about how, like, when you read something, everyone is reading the same thing. Whereas in film, you can focus on, like, so many different things in a shot. But I think people can read the same thing and get totally different, you know. There's still, like, a very interpretive element to reading, but it's not in the same way.
Poetry is actually really something. Well, I think poetry is something that can be highlighted. I was reading The New Yorker today, which shouldn't sound fancy, because I was literally...
Oh, I was reading The New Yorker today.
Yeah, I was. I was very fancy. I was waiting in my... I was waiting for the shrink. I was like, I need some shrink time. I need to talk to my shrink. So I was sitting in the waiting room, and I was reading The New Yorker, and I came across a poem. I don't normally actually like the poetry in New Yorker. I think it's too big for its britches. But I was reading this one little bit. I think poetry is a really good example, because so many people fixate on the actual words, reading them as sentences. But I think if you read each poem's line, where the line breaks are, you read them each as its own separate statement, you can actually, like, really play with some really weird stuff. I think a good poet is, like, paying attention to that, making sure that, like, reading it as if it was a grammatical sentence makes sense, but then also being able to use those line breaks to create, like, a totally different experience. I think good fiction does that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not saying, like, one is unable to do it. It's more like the type of opportunities and how it does it is different. It's only through that type of meta experimentation that it really comes out. So a good example of this that has nothing to do with movies or literature, but everything to do with them at the same time is porn games.
Jesus.
So if you don't know what a porn game is, they're
nothing. I've seen you play these porn games and they're like all despicable. Like, I'm a degenerate. I want to have sex with the Grinch and Bruce Willis. But like, these porn games you play are like horrifying. It's like people getting fucked by pigs. It's
awful. My God.
Okay, those are a very specific type of porn games. So I'm just talking about like normal visual novels. But I like to call them porn games because, you know, it's kind of the joke.
Because you're an edgelord. Because you're an edgelord. Yes. You're an edgy lord.
So a visual novel really is just a choose your own adventure novel where you pick choices and then you end up with different girls or per se. And Doki Doki Literature Club, which came out, has like not ruined this, but like made this type of work very common now. It used to be kind of like an interesting way for games to, or like the final twist is that all the characters have always been talking to you, or that there is a character actually behind you that has never been addressed. And then you like realize it at the end of the twist. Of course you can do this in books. Of course you can do this in movies. But because it's in a visual novel where you're spending 4 hours making choices that you think you're making choices for a main character, and suddenly like, oh fuck, I was always the one making a choice.
Well, I think talking about that difference is important. I mean, right, there's no way you could make the experience. I don't know if anyone has played Binding of Isaac. But there's no way you could experience Binding of Isaac in a book or a movie. I mean, it's just like because of the like fundamental gameplay loop, right? I think there are things that are specific to mediums that can be played with, right? I mean, it's the difference between watercolor and oil painting.
Yeah, so I find these type of movies more interesting than like New Hollywood, where you can adapt. In fact, a lot of New Hollywood is adapted from books. And of course, the conversations between the adaptions are interesting, but for me, the experimentation of the meta is just like, it gets me more.
Well, I mean, Spider-Man No Way Home, which I've not seen and don't plan on seeing, it could be a movie, it could be a book, it could be a comic book, it could be a radio drama, and it could probably be a video game without much editing, right? I mean, you can, because it's like a simple narrative. As long as you can tell an A to B story, you've got it done.
You like these movies where the medium is made super explicit. And I think that's cool. It makes sense.
I also liked what you said, Walter, but I hate you.
Okay.
So I don't know how to reiterate that. It's important to me that that's said, though.
That's very fair. That's very fair. I also want to be really unprofessional and use the bathroom.
I wrote down that novel that you talked about because I love, my favorite kind of books to read are the ones that are like poetry or like also like nonfiction narrative.
Yeah, no, Split Tooth's really good. I got in 2 softback copies and I sold it the same day. I have a soft spot for novels that are basically memoirs.
Yeah, me too.
I need to finish it because I only read about 4 chapters before I sold them, but I'd like to get a copy. And that actually came from, shout out to Nat D. I'm not going to say their full name and all that. You know who you are. Good taste, good books, one of my favorite customers. I actually, there's this customer that come in who I really like. It's this couple. Again, I'm not going to say their names, but they come in and we always chat. And I mistakenly told them that we're recording this podcast. And they were like, what is it? And I was like, oh God, please no. But I told them, and I hope they don't think I'm a monster, because I am one. Hopefully they like don't listen to the episodes where I want to talk about fucking the Grinch or like.
Yeah, that's why it was like I said, I made, like I have a private Twitter and a public Twitter. I wasn't sure if I should post the podcast in my like academic Twitter account. Exactly. I was like, I mean, I could, like, it's something that I'm doing and people share their personal lives, but I'm like, maybe it would be bad.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's the sticky wicket. I don't much care. I mean, like, I like, my job is pretty low stakes. The closest I had to do to that is I got interviewed at one of the city council meetings because I had some pretty angry things to say about what the city council was doing to the homeless. I said some things and then I had to tell them. I basically told the interviewer asked me what I think should be done, like if I had any closing statements. And I told him that I think people, if you know who's at these meetings, who's the businesses downtown who are supporting the harassment of the homeless people, you should stop going there. And I actually had to buckle. I had to backtrack and be like, actually, I don't think you can put that on air because I also work downtown. And like, you know, it's like I would, my boss would be angry. So that's the closest I've come to like having to like not be a degenerate and not be a degenerate. Fuck the businesses that are trying to lean more on the homeless people. They're fucking terrible. And it makes more work for me because then they all come to me for help.
What actually happened was my stomach wasn't feeling very good, so I really needed to go diarrhea for a bit.
Oh no!
I apologize. That was really embarrassing. Okay, yeah, sorry, I'll get back into it. Fuck it. I did want to talk a little bit about the film. I just wanted to say, like, one of my favorite parts in the movie was that sometimes you would see the actresses be more emotional, and sometimes you would see the people telling the stories be more emotional, and that was really fun. It was fun to see the different type of interpretations of normal stories or daily life stories, and a lot of the stories were about moms, a lot of stories were about their children. A lot of them were single women who've been divorced a few times.
It reminds me a little bit of the Vagina Monologues, right? That the Vagina Monologues are stories written by people and then performed by others, right? It's like similarly like a transference of experience in some ways.
Yeah. Actually, maybe this film is basically Vagina Monologues, the Brazilian sequel. I've never heard someone compare it to it like that, probably because the director is a male director. But it would be interesting if someone was like, this is basically just the Vagina Monologues. I wouldn't even disagree with that. My favorite part in the film, though, is that one of the actresses, she starts crying, and the real part...
Of course that's your really favorite part. Of course that's your favorite part, where you get to watch women cry. You pervert! You absolute pervert!
Oh,
how
no.
dare you!
Is this actually just a fetish? Fuck!
How dare
no.
you!
No! It's more complicated than that, I swear!
Okay.
The real enactment didn't have much tears, so Kong Tin-ho, he questioned her. She was like, why did you cry? What were you thinking about when you cry? And she talks a little bit about that, but that's like lame. I don't give a fuck. But what she says that's actually very interesting.
Such a dick. Such a mean person. So mean-spirited.
The most authentic tears are the ones you hold back. But the irony of that is that acting or television or movies always tries to draw the audience's attention to those held back tears. I thought about that concept, and I feel like it's kind of the irony of storytelling or filmmaking even. Like, the most authentic experiences of documentaries or filmmaking or all these understandings of it is like the natural, the authentic. But if you know you're filming it, it kind of breaks that authenticity. I thought that was like a really nice metaphor.
I've never met someone who is so pretentious and so mean at the same time. Just like an angry academic turtle. Just like ready to, I'm feeding him a carrot and he bites me. How dare you?
What did I do that was mean? Tell me that what I did was mean.
I don't care about the woman who's crying. I don't care why she's crying. I don't care. I just want to see her tears. I just want to drink them.
Oh.
You monster. Are you cranking it right now? Are you cranking your hog, Walt?
He's having stomach issues.
He's crying and he's pooping so much. It's so sad. I feel small for you. I do. I really do. I feel like at the end of every podcast, we learn something about ourselves and each other. And I think that's good. I think we're growing as people.
I don't think I learned anything today.
Okay. Well, that hurts my feelings a little bit. But okay. I learned double. I learned for you and me, Catherine. I think probably the only thing left to say is if you're listening to this on whatever you're listening to it on, be sure to give it 5 stars, rate it, tweet about it, Twitter about it, make a TikTok about it, mail it in a letter.
Give it a little kiss.
Yeah, give it a kiss. Just pull it in real close. Give it a little kiss. If you leave a review, a 5-star review with some text, and it's funny, we'll read it on air. As long as it's not like bad. You're not going to trick me into saying any racial slurs. That's not happening. You might be able to trick Walter. He's pretty dumb. Thank you all for joining us again, and remember, if you're going to watch a movie, do it with the lights off.